Good morning on this cold and snowy day. I hope that you are warm and safe at home today and that you have a wonderful Sabbath day and a blessed week. God bless you today. I'd like to begin today by reading to you a passage of scripture. This is from John chapter 2 verses 1 through 11, and I am reading in the New International Version. On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied. "My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." They did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. But you have saved the best till last." What Jesus did here in Cana in Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. It's a familiar story, isn't it? I'm sure we've heard it more than one time. As we look around us at the condition of our world, especially here in the United States, we might wonder about the condition of marriage in our country. And yet this wedding was a wonderful wedding in Cana of Galilee. I myself, many years ago, before the divorce rate became so high, came from a family in which my mother was married four times, divorced three. It's very difficult for children, and people did that for a variety of different reasons, but the most common one used was, "Let's stay together for the sake of the children." And as one of those children, I want you to know that it was not for my sake that they stayed together. It was not a good situation, very dysfunctional. My husband and I are a blended family. I am married for the first time to my husband, Tom, and I am his second wife. He divorced his first wife. It became more and more common as I was growing up to talk to people about their families, other young people like myself, and to discover that their parents were divorced and that there was either a stepdad or a stepmom, and that sometimes it was even a single parent family that they were coming from. How much better it is when our children have both parents with them, both a mother and a father, a mothering person and a fathering person. Often nowadays, that comes down to grandparents who offer that for those grandchildren. Our own grandchildren, we have a set of twin girls who are in college now, and they will graduate from college next year. But they grew up in a variety of different home settings, and even for them, grandmas and grandpas became the anchor persons in their lives who gave mothering and fathering to them so that they would have that sense of security. There were others as well. Mom was present and active, and Dad was present and active, but it wasn't like having two engaged with them. What would it take now for our country to turn around and for marriage to become something vital and important in our society again? You know, since 2015, when marriage was redefined by the Supreme Court, it has become even more confusing about how we should approach that situation. People are determining that they will live together and not get married, or that they will not engage in a traditional marriage. Perhaps in some cases, it's that both mom and dad or both partners in the marriage are working sometimes working at opposite times, so only one parent is with kids at the same time. And none of these situations are good. Sometimes it's just a marriage of convenience, because being married means that you can file your taxes jointly, you can get family insurance that will take care of both of you. Sometimes it has to do with death or medical decision rights that come into the family, and it is just convenient. It saves some money for two people to live together in that relationship that otherwise would be getting paid twice as singles. So these are not the biblical reasons for getting married. These are not the reason God created and ordained a man, Adam, and a woman, Eve, so that Adam would have a helper in his life. And the word helper, as it was used in the writing of the book of Genesis, meant that there would be a contradictory or different point of view that would come into the relationship through the woman, and that Adam would be strengthened and made wise through living into that relationship with the woman. Over time, relationshiping in marriage, even in the Old Testament, did not stay pure the way God intended it to be. We have to come into, for example, the time of Abraham and Sarah, when Abraham was traveling through the kingdom of Gerar and presented his wife Sarah as his sister, so that the king of Gerar took her into his harem. And it was God himself that stood in the way of sin that was being on the edge of happening because Sarah was in his harem, and told the king that he was as good as dead because of Sarah. But in the time of David, we see adultery happening, adultery that was against the Ten Commandments because the marriage partners were to be faithful to each other. Even the commandment to not covet your neighbor's wife, which is precisely what David did and then committed adultery, came into the whole setting when it came to marriages, and more political marriages were happening. In the days of Solomon, he had 700 wives and 300 courtesans. How does that play out as being faithful in marriage? And so we come into our present day, but we are going to do that by way of the story of the wedding at Cana in the New Testament. The New Testament has very much to say about weddings and marriage. In fact, marriage is held up as an image of the relationship between God and his church, between Jesus and his church, that the church is the bride of Christ. And Jesus spoke at one point to Pharisees, and the Pharisees were making an argument with Jesus about divorce. And they claimed that Moses had given them the law that they could write a letter of divorce and give it to their wives and be divorced from her. And Jesus said, "Moses gave you this law because of the hardness of your hearts." Jesus reminded them that from the beginning it was one man, one woman, Adam and Eve, ordained by God, chosen for God's purpose to live together in unity. Also, Jesus included these things in parables. One of those parables has to do with 10 virgins. 10 virgins who were waiting for the arrival of the groom to come to the wedding feast. And they had with them lamps, but only 5 of them had brought oil with them and were actually repaired. In this particular parable, the king's feast is actually a heavenly feast that they are being welcomed into. And the virgins that were not wise enough to bring oil with them and to be truly ready had gone away to buy oil, so that they were not there when the groom arrived, and the doors were shut and they could not get in. And they asked at the door and they were told, we don't even know you. In addition to this one, there is the parable of the feast that was prepared for the bridegroom and was waiting and ready, and the bridegroom was about to come, but none of those who had been invited came to the feast. So the king sent out his couriers and servants to gather people from all kinds of different places, no matter who they were, no matter what social echelon they were at, they were invited to come into the wedding feast, except that one of them turned up without the wedding garments on. And we don't know exactly what was intended by that. It might have been one of the original guests who had decided to come to the feast and hadn't bothered to come when it was supposed to happen, but had come late to the feast. Or it might have just been someone who snuck in, seeing all the activity. But that person was cast out because they were not dressed in the garments that the other guests were dressed in. Again, this is representative of a heavenly feast when Jesus will be joined by his bride, and there will be a great feast in heaven, and God and Jesus will have provided all of the garments that we may need, all of the freshness and newness in our lives that we will need in order to be in the kingdom of heaven for that banquet. These things tend to tell us a little bit about the way weddings were conducted back then. You see, in the days of Jesus, weddings were not done in a synagogue or the temple, or at least it would have been a rare thing. They were rather done within a local setting, perhaps even within a family's home, and they actually consisted of two parts. There was the wedding itself, which would have been conducted with a feast. And there was an earlier part that was called betrothal. Sometimes we hear the betrothal compared to our engagement practices, but it really was much more than that and quite different. We look down on the idea of someone paying a bride price as though the woman is being bought and is human trafficked in that situation. I want to tell you about a friend whose name is Patrick Chibridge. Patrick is from the country of Uganda in Africa. And he is a missionary as a very young man, even a teenager. He went on a mission trip and was captivated by the people he met there who were very poor. And over a couple of years, God continued to call him to return to the area that he had been in as a missionary and to begin teaching the children in that area. And he started a school with very humble beginnings under a tree where he taught the children. Over about 10 years, that school has grown and grown and grown to the point where their earliest education through about 8th grade is now going to include a high school because they've been taking care of the children long enough that they need that level of education. What a joy and a praise it is to watch God work in this situation. But my husband and I have been supporting Patrick for quite some time, and we had the privilege and joy of being on the sidelines as he was becoming married to his wife. One of the first things that was required was an interview by the family, and short on the heels of that, he had to pay what would be the equivalent of a bride price to the family. And while this, to us, represents human trafficking, it was not. Both of them truly loved each other. But this was necessary. Patrick was living in impoverishment. He was very young. He'd never held down any other kind of job. And this family and this bride needed to know that Patrick was serious about caring for his wife and providing for her, and that he would do what was necessary in order to do that, that he had the drive and the discipline in order to accomplish what was necessary to take care of their daughter. What a joy it was. And they are happily married with several children of their own and one that they have adopted from among the children that they have been in the process of educating. This is how it would have been conducted in Jesus' day. The first thing to happen was a meeting that would include the daughter and the groom, and if the groom had parents who were living, then they would have been present too, looking after the concerns having to do with these two young people. And contractually, they would determine what the responsibilities of the husband was going to be, what the responsibilities of the wife was going to be, the things that were necessary in order for them to get married, that typically included a space for them to live in, either separate from the groom's father's home or in the groom's father's home. And the woman was going to be responsible for preparing so that there would be dishes and linens or cloths for them to use and bedding and all of those more domestic kinds of things. And they would spend somewhere in the neighborhood of a year in this condition of betrothal. Now, this was contractual for all intents and purposes. They were married and to remain faithful to one another, even if it meant that they had bedded for the first time. They were not considered to be in sin for that because they were married. Although it was frowned upon, this betrothal period needed to be honored in their lives together. Wouldn't it be good if our young people today were spending more time considering and preparing for the future and less time engaging with one another as though they were already ready for it? So now if we go into our scripture for today, we can see some of these things playing out at the wedding at Cana. The scripture tells us that this was the third day. Now, there have been things that had happened, and in some of the Gospels, there is a timeline that is shared in the telling of the Gospel story. A wedding took place in Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there. We may wonder about the role of Mary in this story. In all likelihood, this was some family member. A niece or a nephew, perhaps, who was getting married on this particular day. And Mary was there as part of the family, assisting with all of the preparations for the wedding feast and everything that would happen ahead of time. Jesus was invited to the wedding along with his disciples, and this may have been like a formal invitation given out ahead of time, reminding him that he could be present and should be with his friends at the time of the wedding feast ahead of the day when it would happen, which was an important thing because after the betrothal, it was the groom's father who would identify for the groom the day when the groom could go and bring his bride home. In other words, Dad was keeping an eye on what the son was doing and making sure that there was appropriate living space for the groom and the bride to be living in. So Jesus was invited along with his disciples. So they would have been watching for the day when the wedding feast would occur in order to be present for that. On the day when the groom was released by his father to go and bring his bride home, he would have gone to the bride's house, and on the return trip, it would have been quite a celebration and kind of like a parade because people would be joining them along the way and celebrating that the groom was with his bride and so on. And they would arrive together at the feast held either in the groom's home or in the home of the father if they were going to be living in the father's household. And so, and in this particular case, it probably is the groom's home. So again, we have that flavor of the heavenly feast. The Father's realm is where that heavenly feast will take place, where Jesus will be joined by his bride, the church. And as they were celebrating this new marriage, the wine in the household ran out. We especially see that Mary had a specific role here because she was giving instructions to the servants. How did that happen? If it were not for the fact that she was somehow involved with this family at a closer level and had some authority in that household as far as the servants were concerned, that they would listen to her and that she would feel comfortable and free to take instructions to them. But before she did that, she went to Jesus and she said, "They've run out of wine." The preparation for the celebration had not anticipated the number of guests or the length of the time that the celebration would continue, and they were in need of more supplies. Supplies were running short. And Jesus looked at his mother, and he said, What do I have to do with you, woman? My time has not yet come. And there are several reasons why this is precious, because who should attention be on the day of a wedding? Not one of the guests, right? It should be on the bride and the groom. That's where our attention goes. So Jesus did not steal the limelight in any kind of way from this couple. But Mary went in anyway and went to the servants and she said, "Do whatever he tells you to do." And Jesus also went to the servants, and he saw there 6 very large jars that water was used for what would have been like a baptism among the Jewish people, ritual bathing, for the sake of ritual cleanliness, having done something that made you ritually unclean among the Jews, or it would have been used for the baptism water of someone who was converting to Judaism among Gentiles. And Jesus instructed the servants to fill those jars with water, which they did. They filled it clear to the brim. And he stood there and he watched. And he was present as the water flowed. And then he told the servants to take a dipper of it to the master of the banquet. Well, in this case, I would say probably the master of the banquet is a servant, a head servant in the household who is providing oversight for the conduct of the banquet itself. And the dipper of water is taken to this master of the banquet, and he tastes it, and behold, it is wine. Now, so far as he knows, they have pulled out some additional supply, and they are bringing it to him for the sake of a mere approval. But he is surprised because it is so good, this wine. So he goes to the groom, whose house this would be occurring in. He goes to the groom and he says, almost everyone serves their good wine at the beginning of the banquet. And then, when the guests have already had too much to drink, they bring out their cheaper wines. But you have saved the best until last. And no one knew where the wine came, or at least almost no one. Mary knew. The servants who had put the water into the jars, filling them to the rim, didn't have to taste it. They knew it was water. And the disciples of Jesus, they caught on to about what this was all about. This is how important weddings are, marriage is, to the Lord Jesus and to God. This is how important. During our time together, my husband, has served 6 years in 3 small churches called the North Parkersburg Charge, and he conducted a wedding about once a year while he was doing that. I have served for 12 years, almost twice as long as he did, and I've done only 4. This has mostly to do, probably, with the settings. I was in a church where the one wedding that I might have done, the family had elected to use a different pastor, and I didn't have the opportunity to do it. And in general, the congregations that I've served in haven't experienced any weddings among people who are in attendance. But the grateful thing in this situation is that God has watched over us. Because it's important to me that if I do a marriage, it's going to last. It's going to be a lifetime commitment in the eyes of God. That there are 3, not just 2, engaged in that marriage. And that one of them is God and Jesus. And that this partnership will hold together for the purposes that God has in bringing these 2 together. I always insist on 4 meetings for marriage counseling ahead of time. And so did my husband. And the blessing is that all of these marriages are still in existence, even though personally I'm very reluctant and standoffish about performing weddings. For this reason, because of the marriage license, every pastor that performs a marriage becomes an agent of the state. And that can and is in opposition to being the agent of God in this practice. For the sake of bringing these 2 together, committing them to one another in the eyes of a congregation who will support them and hold them accountable, with an understanding that it is God that has brought this about and that it is for God's purposes. All of this is in the New Testament when it comes to marriages. Some years ago, before 2015, which is when the Supreme Court ruled that a marriage is the union of two persons, I had submitted to our general conference a request, a resolution that the United Methodist Church would conduct a study of the meaning of marriage. Now, they've done this in the past. They have produced guidelines and a document that has to do with the sacrament of baptism. They've done, likewise, a study and a document that relates to the sacrament of Holy Communion. Well, sometimes we call marriage holy matrimony. What does that mean? Especially in a setting that is very challenged when it comes to providing clear understanding of the commitment made by two persons before God when they join their lives together. My proposal was rejected. That probably means that it was rejected in committee, perhaps because there were not enough other things on the docket that were similar, and also possibly because I was very novice at producing something like that and didn't quite do it well enough and hadn't engaged enough support for it at various levels of the church. Did you know that you can do that? That you, in the structure of the United Methodist Church, have the ability to produce a resolution and have it considered by the entire global church and voted on as to whether or not it will become part of the Book of Discipline or not. It's quite exciting, actually. And the reason I bring it up is this. I still think that somewhere along the line, that is what needs to happen. That in order to bring into the lives of young people, we need to be clear about what we mean when we talk about marriage, what it involves, what it should look like, and who is engaged for nurturing, for advising and giving wisdom, and holding accountable those who are engaged in marriage. For the sake of those young people that are coming up behind us, we should be doing that now. God bless you. Have a great week. Stay warm, stay safe.